This is Saturday with Claire Byrne. You're very welcome to the programme. You can text us at 51551, email saturday@rte.ie, and on Twitter it's at SaturdayRTE. Joining us in the studio today, we have Minister for Employment Affairs and Social Protection Regina Doherty, Dara O'Brien, Fianna Fáil TD, Pather Tobin, Sinn Féin TD, John Moran, social entrepreneur, member of the board of the European Investment Bank and former Secretary General of the Department of Finance, Katie Hannan, primetime political correspondent and soon to be presenter of the Late Debate on RTE Radio 1 on Wednesday night. You're all very welcome to the programme. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Now, first things first, let's start with a story that our listeners may have heard on the news there about Leo Varadkar in an interview broadcast on the BBC. He explained his position on abortion. Well, quite briefly outlined his position, Minister. Were you expecting him to say what he said today, or were you hoping and thinking that he would wait until after your special cabinet meeting on Monday?
Well, I think, he just answered a question that he was asked, and I don't think what he said this morning, based on his own personal views, are anything different to what he had said previously. I think the only new thing that I heard this morning was that he plans on campaigning, which is, I think, from my perspective, is very welcome, because I don't know how you would have a government to propose a referendum and not campaign on it. And given that what we want is the middle ground to be able to have their voices in this campaign, I think that's very, very welcome. But we've a special cabinet meeting on Monday night where we have three decisions to make. And having, I suppose, Leo listened extensively not only to his own PP, our wider membership within Fine Gael, but also the views of everybody else in Leinster House and across the public realm, he'll make his own statement, I think, on Monday evening as to what exactly his views are, but far more importantly, what the roadmap is for the government with regard to the referendum in the coming months.
So you'll be told on Monday night what the advice is from the Attorney General, and we believe that it is repeal and an enabling piece of legislation which will allow the Oireachtas to decide on abortion in the future.
Yeah, there's three things that we need, three decisions that we'll make on Monday evening. One is to have a referendum or not, and I'm obviously assuming that the decision of Cabinet is to have the referendum. The second thing is to take the Attorney General's advice on whether it should be repeal simpliciter or repeal enabler. And the third thing is to give the permission for the Minister for Health to draft the legislation and then publish it that will accompany it. Now, they're the three decisions that we'll make on Monday. They will be obviously broadcasted immediately after the Cabinet meeting, but then Leo will make a statement on his own views. So okay. Looking forward to it, I suppose.
Dara, Micheál Martin this week, we heard a lot from him about how he arrived at his decision. It didn't seem to make any impact, though, on his approval rating or on Fianna Fáil's approval. No, it's just interesting because does it tell us that the voters don't really care about politicians and what they think on repeal?
Well, I think, look, obviously, and it goes without saying, I know you're not suggesting, there's no question that any of us who make any comments on this, and Micheál in particular, which I thought was a very well put together, very courageous speech as well, and showed a great deal of leadership in it. We're not doing it for poll numbers or for popularity. This is a very, very serious, it's a very personal issue. What I would, if I could just say in relation to the Taoiseach's comments as well, I did find it to a degree curious that he chose to make his announcement on the BBC firstly, not in the Dáil, and is it coincidental that it was the day after a very significant poll? So I just put it that way. I think he should use the Dáil.
What do you think the aim was?
Firstly, it's the international media. I think to choose the BBC to make a significant comment like that, I would think that the Dáil is the best place to do it, like most of us have actually done on an issue like this. He is the Taoiseach, he is the leader, it's his government who will be bringing forward the proposals. We don't know what they are yet. Regina's outlined there the process, but I would have thought the Dáil would be far more appropriate than the BBC to make those comments. Having said that, I don't think any of us who are involved in this debate, I think it will be respectful. It is a personal matter. I think my party leader was to the forefront of ensuring that in my own party since 2013 that we've a conscience vote on it, and most of us now have spoken in the Dáil and set out what our view is in the absence of having a government proposal, I might add. So all of us will be acutely interested in to see what is going to be proposed, because most people, I think myself included, would have expected maybe an amendment to 43.3, a replacement, not just a pure repeal, dealing with the really with the issues of fetal abnormality, rape and incest. Now, obviously, the Oireachtas Commission.
But we all know, why we are where we are of that Oireachtas Committee and the Citizens Assembly.
And absolutely, and look, I used my opportunity in the Dáil, which is our Parliament, to actually outline what I thought. I just think that it would have been more appropriate that rather than make the announcement on the BBC, that the Taoiseach would have actually come into the Dáil and actually outline
his stall. Okay, Katie Hannan, what do you think? That's a fair point?
I did think it was a strange decision, given that he's been asked at every turn by the Irish media and in the Dáil in recent weeks what his position was, and he's played his cards extremely close to his chest. And this is, and he's still playing them close to his chest. And we've only got a little peek, and he's you know, he's given some indication of where he was. I think the fact that he wanted to put that out there to his own cabinet members as much as anything else, to give them an idea of where his head was as they were about to go into that cabinet meeting. You know, because if he was going to, you know, land them with some position that they weren't expecting, that could become a difficult cabinet meeting. So I think it's very deliberate. I think he's played a smart game, though, because it's quite clear that there are concerns within Fine Gael of this liberalising the abortion legislation to the degree that has been proposed. And they're worrying if the 12-week mark, the 12-week cut-off point, is maybe a step too far for people who may go along with the idea of repealing the Eighth Amendment, that that type of legislation might be a step too far. And I think he's been, I think he must understand that he must handhold a considerable section of the Fine Gael support base to bring them across that line, if that is the line that he indeed intends to take them to.
But what we know about Leo Varadkar this weekend is that he is the new Teflon Taoiseach. At 60% approval rating. Why are you laughing at that?
It's hilarious. It's one poll. Leo won't be standing in every Dáil constituency either. And the other thing is, which is curious, that it's a great poll figure for him to have at 60%.
You're jealous, Darren.
No, I'm jealous, for God's sake. But the other item in the poll, which everything else was kind of static, with the exception of Fine Gael dropping in the poll, which is what happened in the last two. So, look, it's a great figure for him. But I would say this, though, as well, when the poll, very detailed as it was the announcement that he made, you know, timed to see, well, OK, what is the people's view on the future referendum, you know, in being safe to say, well, now I'm going that step further because it looks like the people are with me on this.
It's difficult.
And I think that's the type of thing of this PR type arrangement that he seems to have, and his own spin team, is everything is focused on, you know, what people will think about
it's
it.
It's working
what the
for him, though.
Saying.
I mean, Fianna Fáil, you're at your 2016 election results level.
We're actually higher than that.
In and around.
And in fairness,
you know,
in fairness,
the point is, it's working for him.
In fairness, I think if it's working for him at the moment, the only time we'll know whether it's actually working for him is when we actually go to the polls, whenever that is. And we've always, I would remind Claire on that many, many times in this studio, I have stated that it consistently, our support is underrepresented in the polls, and we've been proven right. But we don't spend all day looking at polls. But the interesting thing on this one is the fixation with the popularity of Leo. I would ask the question out again, was the announcement that he made in line with the poll?
Okay.
Just be safe and be popular.
Heather.
It's an interesting issue. The abortion issue is actually taking over the political process at the moment, for sure. And most of the other really important issues out there are taking a backseat. Now, abortion is very, very important, so it's natural that that would happen to a certain extent. I don't think there's any, let's say, party political advantage to any party on the issue of abortion, because the fact is that most political parties would have people on both sides of the fence on it. There is a potential that if the abortion issue is to take centre stage at every single debate that we have on politics, that the government, to a certain extent, won't be held to account on the other issues that are of serious problems. And in a way, like summertime, for example, and holiday breaks are good for governments in that the governments don't get the same scrutiny. There is a possibility that during the abortion debate that Leo and Fine Gael won't get the same scrutiny on those other issues because the rest of the country will be consumed by this particular issue for the next 5 months. So that possibly could be part of the issue. I just think it's strange that the leader of the country can't actually say what he feels about a certain issue, that he hasn't got the courage of conviction to say, you know, this is where I stand on a particular issue of, you know, life and death, no matter what perspective that you're coming
at. He is going to say it. He's waiting for the Attorney General's advice. He has said what he has said today and will know more on Monday. It's not as though he's refusing to say it ever.
Leo keeps putting his toe in the water to see what the temperature is before he's going to determine what he's going to say in the particular issue.
I
don't think that's a courageous thing for a person to do. If I was a voter of Leo Varadkar's. I'd simply just want to know, what does Leo Varadkar actually think on the issue right
and
now?
And you will. So when he has received all of the advice, as he has to, as the most senior politician in this country from the Attorney General, as to what government's position is going to be, and then at that stage he'll share his personal views
with you. Regina, you're confident enough to come,
to have a personal view
to come out in this
shared
issue
with people before we have a professional government status.
But Regina, how come you're happy? How come you're happy as a government minister to be able to have the strength of conviction to have a personal view on this issue without exactly those things? How come you're more able to do that than Leo? All I'm saying is that if I was an elector in Leo's constituency, I would like to know where Leo stood on something
and
as important as this.
And the people of Dublin West will know after he's made a decision at Cabinet
okay.
on Monday.
I want to move on to something else Leo Varadkar said this week when he made those comments about the Bank of Mam and Dad. Now, Fianna Fáil had an awful hop off and Barry Cowan said that he was putting his posh boy credentials on display. Fair?
No, not fair.
I think what it did do, okay, the language on both sides, it did actually show on this particular issue, particularly in housing, and I say that as someone who's in the adjacent constituency in Fingal and Dublin Fingal, that he's completely out of touch with what the reality is for couples and young individuals and people to try to get on the housing market.
But we learned subsequently that he has 100% mortgage.
Yeah, but it was gas the way I think he rode back because he saw the reaction. He said, oh my God, like there's, I know from my perspective, when I was buying a house and anyone that I represent, very few people are going to go to be able to tap up their folks and say, give us a loan.
Yeah.
Like people have come through an incredibly difficult, particularly all over, like this idea that the Bank of Mom and Dad, you know, that, well, go and ask your folks for a loan, that's part of the solution. It showed in that one comment how out of touch government is and how behind they are in housing and the real situation out there for people.
My head spins to think that we're having similar conversations that we had in 2004, 2005 with regards to this. That what the Taoiseach is saying is that now the property market is so dysfunctional that multi-generational debt and finance is necessary for a person to buy a house. That you have to spread the debt over the parents and their kids for them to be able to buy a house. It shows that there's something wrong with the housing market. I actually, my major worry about this, of course, there's a big problem with regards homelessness and people not being able to buy a house currently. But the way the property market is going at the moment is going to lead to significant instability in the whole economy in the future. Those prices are getting so dangerously high at the moment that it could easily cause another bubble to happen in the future. Houses should be about 4 or 5 times at most the income of an individual. And for most people in the country, that's simply not
okay,
the case at the
but
moment.
But perhaps, and John Moore, and this is where we come to you, it's because most people feel they have to live on the East Coast and in the Dublin region. And the ESRI said today that the focus on those areas is unsustainable and that our politicians have to invest in regional cities. Now, we have had this conversation before many, many times, but you firmly believe that it should have been done yesterday.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I've been saying this for 2 or 3 years now in terms of the run-up to the National Planning Framework. So all of these things we've talked about, the concerns Pat has just mentioned, there is now an opportunity for our politicians to actually get it right. I mean, we've been 100 years not planning the country in terms of how it's growing, and there, and we can see what the problems are. I mean,
can you explain to me why you feel the time is right now to do it?
Well, just in the sequencing of things, right? So there's a National Planning Framework which has been going through consultation. That is essentially the highest level picture of how the country should operate going forward. And out of that comes the decisions about where do we put schools, where do we put hospitals, how do we get people from A to B, where do they live, how long do they commute, and everything else. And it is in many ways the document that's coming very shortly down the tracks. I think it's within a matter of weeks coming down the tracks now. It is the one that's going to raise all of the same old problems we've had in the country about parish politics, everybody wanting one in their own backyard. And it's going to take a brave government, but actually an equally brave Dáil this time round, to finally say, look, we've been doing 100 years of this. We see what's wrong. People are commuting too far, mental issues all across the country. We've got decimation of you know, or at least non-growth in parts of the West in terms of the cities, while Dublin gets bigger and bigger. Of course, Dublin needs to succeed, and we know that, right? But it's actually succeeding. But people are now actually getting to a point, if you look at the debate about this 1,000, you know, mortgages, it's tiny little trinkle at the edge of the housing market.
This
right?
is the affordable
thing.
Loans
but a lot of time consumed on it, you've just been talking about it, it's 1,000 houses. Yeah. We're looking about where 500,000 homes will need to be built and how they will need to be built. And we don't, it's not rocket science, right? It costs 45 or so thousand on average to live in Ireland. The national wage is way below that. The cost of services that we are buying effectively in Ireland are way too high. So if you take 45,000 and you take off of that the cost of health insurance because you finally trust the health system to work properly, if you take out the cost of health of childcare, and then you bring the cost of housing down from 45,000, which is an average, so that means there are people paying more than 45% of their wages on housing. It should be 30.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Bring all that down. But now people actually are living within the national
wage. So how do you get people to live outside of Dublin and the East Coast?
First thing, Claire, is we have to make the delivery of public services cheaper, right? And it's not rocket science. If you actually build a school for 1,000 kids and a hospital that's much bigger, it's actually cheaper to run the education and the health services with those people, right? And then what you need to do is you need to have people living close to those larger areas. We've taken the opposite approach because of this politics. We've had 10 schools of 100 instead of one school of 1,000. When you build the schools in one place and the hospitals, the public services go up and up and up. What we've done in the last 30, 40 years of this country is everything's in Dublin. Right? Which means that people can't afford to live close to those services because there's just too many people. Mm-hmm. Right? So they're living further and further away. They're commuting longer and longer distances. We talked about it on the way in. Mm-hmm. People now think that an hour commute in Dublin is acceptable.
Well, I did until I spoke to John just before the show, because I commute in and I'm lucky enough that I live on a rail line. But if you take it within balanced regional development, that's absolutely needed, but also those within the greater Dublin area, using that phrase, how expensive it is for them and people who are growing up to actually knowing that in many parts of my constituency, they're not going to be able to buy a house.
I was joking when I was asked to come on the programme here today, saying, isn't it ironic we're having this conversation in the middle of Dublin 4, mm-hmm. rather than down in Limerick or down in Cork, with everybody understanding some of the disadvantages that you get trying to commute to get to the services in Dublin rather than being on the other side. We've put our biggest court for criminal matters right beside the Phoenix Park. Is that because the judges live there? Is that because we've got more criminals in Dublin? Right? That could be down in Portlaoise, right beside the prison. Move services out.
But because of our political system, it'll never happen.
Well, I hope it will. And it needs to. And in many ways, that's the point.
Because this new framework will identify, 10 hubs mm-hmm. where the development needs to happen. And then we'll have all the political fighting.
But it shouldn't even have 10, right? No. My point is that we are
just,
such
should just
a small
be Limerick,
country.
John, should it?
Limerick, of course, is in the centre of it. But what it actually should have is it should look at the other cities. It's identified 4 cities, all right? Yeah. And that's a big step forward. Mm-hmm. But it has not, in the last draft at least, identified how those 4 cities can work together to be accountable. There's over a million people in those 4 cities if you add them all up. There's a number of universities, some great hospitals. People in Dublin do not think about them as an alternative. We should be asking, why is RTE selling out of Donnybrook, not moving to Cork?
Claire, in fairness, the over-concentration in Dublin is not good for Dublin either. Dublin is at the limit with regards to transport, with regards to schools, with regards even water access at the moment. So it would be logical to try and build a number of urban areas of critical size in other parts of the country to balance out so that they will become internationally attractive for investment in the future themselves. Other countries have done this, and actually John has pointed to the fact that Aarhus in Denmark is a city that was designed and prospered because of governments using the right tools to make sure that investment was distributed properly. Well, the two biggest problems we have in this country is a lack of investment. We're at the bottom in Europe, other than Romania, for the level of investment that we do in capital infrastructure. And the second thing is 45% of that investment is actually going into the Dublin area. Now, I had the NTA, the National Transport Group, in with us in my committee recently, and I asked them, on what basis do they invest? And they said, purely on demand. Now, it's logical that you would invest.
So they follow the people.
Exactly. So you're never going to disrupt the trends that we have if your investment is purely on demand. If you want to make sure that you have other growth areas in the country, you have to invest now for future demand. You have to actually say...
So you're saying build it and they will come.
Well, to a certain... I'm not saying you ignore demand. First of all, you increase the level of investment you're involved in, first of all. You do your best to meet the demand, but you always also you also make sure that you are focusing on future demand in other parts of the country.
Starting from scratch. I know what John's saying, he's making a point, but not everything that's been done in the last 100 years was wrong either. There's the basis to actually deliver proper regional development as well.
Katie, what do you want to say?
It's like we just woke up the other day and started having these ideas. I mean, I have lived through decentralisation and that turned into the greatest political bun fight you ever saw. And it was destroyed, really, in terms of its initial, you know, what it was put there to do, or what we were told it was put there to do. But of course, what it was put there to do was to give a little slice of the pie to every single member around the cabinet table. I have lived through the National Spatial Strategy,
which is
an extraordinary amount of work. I mean, there was massive press conferences. There was glossy documents.
We were 20 years ago, though, in fairness.
But it was ignored.
It was ignored.
It was ignored at a time of the greatest development in the country we've ever witnessed. And it was completely ignored. So our fundamental problem here is not having the idea. The idea is, as you say, not rocket science and absolutely the most basic common sense.
But I think one of the problems I have...
Nobody has ever really got to the nub of... The issue is at political level, that ultimately it doesn't work with our political system, because our political system is everyone pulling at each away from each other.
But that's what you need, is you need a plan that actually people buy into and that transcends government. So it's not just for a term of a government and then the new next government comes in and decides, well, you know what, I don't like that bit of it, I'm going to change it. That's what's happening.
But that's what's happening, right? But it, as I said, there is a science to this, right? I mean, places within an hour of each other operate as an economic unit. Places outside of that either are going to fall off from that economic unit or they're going to look to the next closest one. And if you put everything in one place, the rest of the country is fine to feed off of one economic unit. The point about a Western Atlantic corridor to match up with our, you know, tourism success, is that you can build an economic corridor from Galway down to Cork, even as an example. People can actually live on the north side of Limerick and go to work in Galway in less than an hour. It takes longer to get from your house into the Dáil.
So you're saying that you would challenge decisions like putting the new children's hospital in Dublin?
I think the new children's hospital did one great thing. It was beside a big transport node. And a lot of the debate about the children's hospital was, oh, well, when people's kids are sick and they have to drive there, they'll get stuck in traffic. That ignores the reality of our country, that lots of people can't afford cars. If it was out in the M50 or out someplace where cars are the dominant part of planning, we completely discriminate against all the people in the country who cannot afford the 6,000 euros it takes to actually run a car, let alone a second car. Mm-hmm. And again, that's another one of the failings of the place. We've built it on suburbanisation and on cars.
The Children's Hospital would have been great if it was built.
One of the key conversations
that we're having is that the reason that spatial strategies and the regional development plans have failed in the past, as Katie has said, and they've all failed spectacular. It's because of politics, or politicians acting on the basis of parochial interests. So what we have now, from what I'm hearing around the table, is all parties with the view that we do need a regional balanced development plan that's going to be announced in the next couple of weeks. And if everybody around this table represents their own parties, well, then maybe it will actually work this time. Because if we concentrate on the East Coast will fail. If we don't balance the regional development into the four or maybe five at the end of the public consultation when we're finished, regional cities to develop those in a sustainable way, well, then the East Coast will fall over. It will be a victim of its own success.
It can't be one for everybody in the audience with regards to distribution of there does have to be the selection.
That's what politicians but want.
There does have to be a selection of a number of key locations so that they grow to the critical mass on this. And one of the problems I have, though, with this particular report is it focuses on a number of cities in the southwest. Now, it does give proper focus to Cork. I think that most of the population increase is looking to go to Cork. But there is a problem in the northwest of the country, in that Derry, Letterkenny area.
Sligo,
this isn't focused on and that whole area doesn't have the rail connections. It doesn't have the motorway connections, and as a result, it's striking. One of the invisible things that's actually happening due to this imbalance is the change in the demographic profile. Killarney has a population that's on average 10 years older than Balbriggan at the moment. The level of the dependency ratio from those who are working is far higher now in places like the borderlands and the midlands. And that's going to create great problems for the delivery of services in the country. So we have to make sure that young couples are able to go to locations in the West and get two jobs to be able to pay for their house, to be able to raise their families. That's the key objective here.
Well, you've parts of this, parts of the Dublin area. If you take, Patter's mentioned Balbriggan and Mayo, take Swords. Swords is bigger than Limerick population-wise. There's cities within cities that don't have proper transport connections still. So, but if you look at when politicians actually sit down and work together on things, it can work. If you look at, let's say, on cancer care and the centres of excellence, if you look at the furore over that every hospital, people thought every single hospital in the country had to have all the services. And that was a big debate that happened at the time. And there was a lot of fallout and a lot of politicians scoring points off each other at the time. But it was proven to be the right thing to do. So I don't think we have, when you look at the figures and the projections into the future, we don't actually have the luxury of not doing anything, because the East Coast will tip. And that's not good for the people in Dublin either. So we need to get it right.
There are two points I wanted to make, right? One, I can see it starting already, right? We're name checking different parts of the country already. And that's going to be the problem for the next couple of weeks while they try and do this. We just need to be kind of brave on this one, pick one or two central locations, it's not 20, and actually build the services in those locations, and people will potentially have to move. You know, I mean, these are the hard facts of life. I mean, in the 1950s...
Isn't that what they said about decentralisation?
In the 1950s or 1960s...
It is, isn't it?
Well, no, but decentralisation, which of course... decentralisation, which happened with no reference even to the National Spanish Registry.
Some services did move.
If all of the services have been moved... Can I just finish, please? Yeah. If all of the services have been moved to one location, or at most two locations, people who moved would now have careers for their spouses, they would have progression in their careers instead of them all over the country. Mm. The other thing that we haven't mentioned here today yet is climate change, right? We've had flooding, we've had storms, even in this country. In Cape Town, they're turning off the water on April 12th. Because they have no water. Yeah. They're trying to deal with 25 litres of water, whereas average houses in America use 100. I don't want to mention water among a bunch of politicians, because that might start a different debate.
But the
point is that we have to now face up, and this has to be the plan, to a total radical change in the way we actually live in this country.
And things are happening, just to go back to the Limerick example, things are happening in Limerick, aren't they? Things are moving along there in terms of the 2030 plan.
Yeah, and 90% of the people that actually have moved to Limerick would have in a survey said they would recommend to other people to move there. Commute times are 20 minutes. House prices are 200,000. They're not 400,000. You know, cost of living, quality of life issues are becoming more and more important for people. And again, it comes back to my point about cars. We have too many people also making decisions for us who drive all the time. You know, I'm now moving, as I think we mentioned earlier, to Limerick, right? I can now walk all around. I can walk to the train station in 5 minutes. You know, I can go down the street. I can go to the museum. I can do lots of things. There's a park right in front of the house. This is a quality of life that, although I'm lucky to have a house in Dublin, I cannot have in Dublin.
Ah, well, you see, there you go. You've got a house in Dublin. And you know, most people will need to be on the East Coast. There are people who will need to be on the East Coast.
Not necessarily.
We can move. Let's take another example, right, in terms of thinking forward. We have about 100,000 third-level places coming down the tracks, right? I haven't seen any debate about moving all of them out of Dublin.
Moving which?
Right? There's no reason for them to be in Dublin necessarily. Mm-hmm. You could actually move university students to any location, like I moved from Limerick to Dublin in the old days. 100,000 beds would be freed up in the Dublin housing shortage. Those people would live, probably fall in love, get settled in another city in the country and actually stay there, because they would be the talent pool for the new companies. You can use public services to change the debate.
And also technology is helping here. Like, you know, you can develop remote working hubs in Gwydor, in Donegal, for example. Uthras na Gael took to have put in a hub where people can actually come into a centre, can work for international companies all around the world in that location and do their job, and maybe go to Dublin for a half day on a particular one day a week to have a meeting with the rest of the staff. Technology is enabling people to work in different locations in jobs that wouldn't have been rural type jobs previously.
But all of this is obviously eminently sensible and, you know, as you say, common, you know, it's not rocket science. But it strikes me that the only way you could possibly see this being driven forward on a political level is if there was a dedicated department for regional development, a dedicated minister, and a department that, say, like the pub, like.
There was, but
but I'm saying absolutely, and that all other government policy had to be run by it, like deeper in relation to
the
good idea, Regina, like, do you think?
But the government did set up and got rid of it,
because every government decision, really, in relation to capital spend, in relation to services, all of those decisions feed into which way the country will go. And unless there is a minister that has a say whether that fits our plan or that doesn't, I really wouldn't have an awful lot of confidence, given I've seen with previous plans in the past.
What you have, Katie, is a cabinet that's going to make the decision on the basis of a plan for the development of the country for the next 30 years. And it would be, I think, unwise for one person to be responsible for having to build every single school, every single hospital, every single train station, everything.
No, I'm not suggesting
the environment will be responsible for infrastructure and water.
John, communications
will be responsible for broadband. Yeah. This is so far-reaching and encompasses every section of probably every department that it would be too much.
Well, on the broadband piece, I was just going to mention very briefly, like, if you look at it now, even on the East Coast and in places, we have about 500,000 households that are still going to be waiting until 2023 to get the most basic broadband. So if you're talking about remote working, which I agree with what Pander's saying, and it can be done, as someone who worked remotely myself, you can only do it where the IT infrastructure actually stacks up. Mm-hmm. You can't, and that's a barrier to investment. If you say to a firm, well, you're going to move out to St. Margaret's, or you're going to move out to Kilmallock in Limerick or somewhere like that, and if you don't have basic IT infrastructure there and basic broadband, it's going to be a problem.
That is a problem, John.
To Limerick is because I can get broadband in Limerick, I can't get it in Dublin in Island Bridge, right?
Because
it's a location, because Dublin has such bad broadband. But if we're going to do this and remain competitive as a nation, right, we cannot provide the same level of services to everybody if they choose to live in those other locations.
Basic services, like broadband. I think every household should be able to have at least access to it.
We're not there yet. You were talking at the McGill Summer School last summer, I think, and you spoke about spending priorities and investing €100 million for smarter travel across the country when that was half, or the guards' pay rise cost half that much. And you said that's frankly a bad joke.
Yeah, and the point about I was trying to make, right, is I think we also, and I've been close to the decisions on spending, right, and I don't think we take enough heed of the difference between a current spending matter. So you decide to spend €1 million this year on something that is going to recur every year, right? You are signing up to spending sort of, you know, significant millions all the way. If you spend €1 million on a capital issue and you build a school for €1 million or put a hospital bed in this year for €1 million, you can put another one in next year and another one the year before. And we are down, I think it's at 1.6% of GDP on capital expenditure. We spend an awful lot of money in this country.
It should be about 4%.
But we should be about 3 or 4%. Pater is absolutely right. And that requires doubling, requires moving from 4 to 8 billion. We'll see the numbers when they come out in a couple of weeks. It will be derisory in the context of what we need in this country. But that requires another set of hard decisions from our politicians, which is to move from current expenditure into capital expenditure.
Cuts. It means Claire. Building cuts. Houses. So it doesn't rather mean cuts, it means better planning moving forward. And I think actually investing the actual capital that we have is about capital development. As opposed to people.
Political will is really important in this. The government did set up a new department in 2016 after the election called the Regional and Rural Department of Regional and Rural Development. And it basically finished it in the last 6 months and changed it to Community and Rural Affairs. The problem is the next election is going to, we'll be sitting around this table in the next election, you'll be asking us, do we agree with Fine Gael's plan to cut taxes for the next election? And the issue of massive investments that John has mentioned that's necessary in those regional rural areas will fall off the agenda. The political will won't be there to do it.
If we're going to be real, it's this government that's actually bringing forward the National Development Plan. Just in case you've missed it, it's this government that's actually done the extensive consultation for the last number of years to bring forward the four regional development centres that we're proposing.
Romania with regard
it's this
to
government
levels
that
of
will sign it off in the next couple of years that will determine the roadmap for the next 20 years.
When we talk about the next election, if all of the political parties were to come out with, for their next election campaign, a commitment to something like a Western Economic Corridor, we would move a long way in this debate.
All right, let's take a quick break. Back with more after this. Shona has been in touch to say, at long last, a mature debate about the needs of our whole country and the needs of our people. I hope this is the beginning of collective work and policy. Maybe then I might even get a job. And Sandra says that she's over 50 and a mum of six living in County Cavan. Just want to come to the front page of the Irish Independent today because it says that changes to the contributory pension could result in some people getting much less in their state pension than they were expecting. And Willie O'Dea says he's going to ask you, Minister Regina Doherty, about this in the coming days. What do you say to people who might be worried about that story today?
Well, first of all, there's nothing to be worried about. And so the public consultation that we're going to have later on this year to move to a total contributions model will give everybody an opportunity to actually say what kind of a pension systems that we want going forward. For me, the reform is on the basis of that the numbers are shrinking. So we have far more pensioners in the country and the ratio of pensioners to workers is decreasing. So therefore, we can't do nothing. So we have to do something. And actually, I know it's kind of skewed this morning, but I very much welcome the example that they used this morning, because the William, the example that they used in the paper this morning, he, although he isn't real, is a perfect example of a stark anomaly in the current system.
So tell us about that example.
So, because William,
the scary figure was that his pension would be €95 a week.
No, well, here's the problem, right? William works in a foreign country. This particular case happens to be the United Kingdom, from the ages of 18 to 50. And he gets a full pension from the United Kingdom. And then he came here and he worked for 15 years and he gets a full Irish pension under today's system. Now, that's a huge anomaly. And that means that he has been so heavily subsidised by all of the other people who are paying into our social contribution fund for many, many, many more years than William currently is.
So we'll be taking into account his pension from another state.
We will, yeah, absolutely. So it's not our business to give people two pensions. What it's our business is to make sure that the people who are resident in this country or Irish residents living abroad have enough to have a meaningful, you know, and
with the UK,
quality
they don't
of life.
Currently just as they don't actually, like with the UK as it currently stands at the moment, like we've reciprocal arrangements with the UK on pensions as well. So people aren't doubling up on state pensions. I think what needs to be
I'm
done...
I'm sorry, actually, they are.
Well, they're not in many instances, certainly not in private pensions.
I'm sorry, Darren,
one
they
of
are.
The things that Willie has raised, and I raised actually this week on Thursday in the Dáil, was Regina over the last couple of weeks has been talking about correcting this anomaly whereby, you know, nearly 40,000 people since 2012 have had their pensions drastically reduced. It wasn't an anomaly. It was actually a policy decision made by the previous government that was highlighted at the time that it was in particular anti-women. So Regina then announced that we're going to make these changes effective, which would be paid in 2019, backdated to March 2018. There's still going to be about 30% of people who are affected by that change who won't get any recompense under Regina's plan. So when you talk about pensions and pension coverage...
Are they the men?
Yes.
But if you could explain to us what you think the recompense should be for, I'd be very interested.
I would say you should reverse the decision in totality that you and your party made in 2012 that we opposed at the time, because that doubled the threshold of requirements for contributions to reach the full state pension. And that effectively took 36,000 to 38,000 people were affected by it. Now, other items happened over that period of time, not just on public pensions, on private pensions like the private pension levy that took 2.4 billion out, on schemes like the airport pension scheme that the government legislated on. And you're now seeing reductions of 40 to 50, 60% in pensions. You're seeing the CIE pension, the Irish Life pension, you saw the airport pension.
But Dara, would you not concede though that the minister has made a start on trying to fix this anomaly?
I said that on Thursday in the Dáil when I let out. Yes, it's a start. Firstly, though, it wasn't an anomaly. It was a policy decision made by the previous government.
Can
so they're correcting a mistake.
But the final thing I'd say is that
when you talk about pensions and auto-enrolment and what we need to do to get pension coverage, no party undermined the provision of pensions more than Fine Gael over the last 5 years for the number of items that I've actually raised, like the private pension levy, like what you did to the airport pension scheme.
I think Darren needs to be reminded that the reason that the country suffered the amount of cuts that it suffered over the last 10 years was because of the disaster
what
policies
you did on
that Fianna Fáil.
Yeah.
So, okay, if you want me to remind you of the mess that you left the country in 2011, I'd quite happily do it.
If Regina just commits to people that the floor under which that they live their lives will not be damaged, because there's a confidence issue with the government with regards pensions. The fact that they were tapping into the pensions during the crash, the fact that they messed up 40,000 people's pensions in 2012. You know, I know of a woman in my constituency who's 35 euros worse off every week, and that's a big chunk of money for people on that wage. If Regina can actually give people a commitment here today that
you
she is not going to lower the floor under which people...
I've worked in pensions for 15 years,
you certainly don't, Regina.
You two are talking over Pather. Can you give people that assurance that they won't lose out on the basic pension?
when a contribution system is based on the contributions that you make, people will get exactly what they are entitled to do. But as I've said, and I want to give the assurances here, the new system will be based after months of public consultation. And the premise of what government and Department of Social Protection is trying to do is to ensure that when people reach old age pension age of 66 or 67 in the future, that they have a minimum standard of living based on the 34% of a medium of average industrial wage. That's not going to change. Can I have to just take issue with Dara, who's apparently an expert on pensions.
Well, I worked in pensions
for 15
years, Regina.
The reason that Dara was inaccurate in his statement on Thursday.
Just saying.
Your sanctimonious attitude is incredible. And it really speaks volumes. You know, you're so upset about the polls this morning, you might reflect on why your polling numbers are so bad. The issues that he raised on Thursday was that apparently I was discriminating against people who were self-employed. Self-employed stamp was introduced in 1998, and anybody who has paid a self-employment stamp since 1998 gets that contributed towards their pension. They didn't pay a stamp beforehand. Is Dara assuming that we should give people credit for paying stamps when they didn't pay stamps? He made an announcement that people who were sick were being discriminated against. There's a 10-year illness credit for people who have been sick, and it's always been there. It wasn't introduced in 2012. He made a suggestion that people who were on training courses were being discriminated against. Well, anybody in this country who was on a training course most likely was either in ANCL or FOSS, and they would have got their credits associated with those. And he made suggestions that people who worked away were getting gaps in their employment history. We have bilateral,
very quickly.
We have bilateral agreements with the vast majority of countries. First of all of the countries within the EU and many, many more countries outside of so that your credit history comes with you. The one thing that he did raise on Thursday was that we were discriminating against people who years ago went to college because we weren't allowing them to have credits for those. Well, we don't give people in college today credits to the Social Insurance Fund, and if you really would like to have that conversation, I'd love to know how you plan to pay for it.
For fear of attracting any further ire from Regina on this, the reality of it is that the cuts that the previous government brought in and the changes they brought in 2012 affected about 36,000 people. Her own department
42,000
her own department have actually said that they reckon that about 62% of those affected will be that those changes will be reversed, not backdated back to 2012, but that those changes will affect about 62%. Therefore, 38% will not have any recompense on it. And all I just say is, it's a simple question to Regina: will she reverse the changes she made in 2012?
It's not a simple question that I haven't already answered on numerous occasions. The answer is no.
John, I want to come to you on this.
Are you listening? I've said that a number of times, but you're obviously not listening.
Are you listening to this and thinking this comes back to our spending choices again?
This is exactly what was going through my mind, right? Was here we're going through, again, another debate. We've just had broad unanimous agreement around this table a little bit of time ago about the need for more capital expenditure in the country. And these are the choices. These are the kind of current expenditure choices that would sound like nice things to give, you know, if you think that money is free. And these are the choices that we have to make. And that's why I kind of was actually somewhat positive going into the break. I'm a lot more negative now about my colleagues around the table here. And when they get back into Dáil Éireann, will they be able to actually do what we need to do, which is to do investment with the idea of bringing down the costs of public services and living in this country, because that's the only way we'll actually bring people's lives back to a normal basis. I mean, we know what the national wages are. We should have the cost of living on an average basis for the majority, effectively the average, so it means for most people in the country, at that level, and we support the people below that. What we're doing at the moment is we're trying to support people to a cost of living that's 45,000 euros, way above the national wage, and it's costing too much out of the public purse.
Paul, does that make sense to you?
Like, all we're asking is that there's a floor put under people's ability to fund their lives when they become pensioners. As simple as that. And what we're asking not to happen is that sections of pensioners are removed from that floor. So, you know, in the case of the 2012 decision where a section of pensioners were removed from that floor, we're just saying that's wrong. And that if you take that money off them, return it to them. And that's not happening here at the moment. I agree. In the end of the day, you know, it makes no sense for governments just to throw sweets around with regards current spending every year, because that obviously becomes more expensive on future generations. But we do need to put a floor under people's ability to pay for their lives.
Okay. Could I just say that floor actually exists, because it's called the non-contributory pension, and anybody that doesn't have the contributions to get a pension, a full pension, a 95% pension, is entitled to apply for the non-contributory pension. And we have nearly 100,000 pensioners in this country that the state fully supports with the non-con pension. So it's there.
All right, another quick break, back after this. We want to turn now to the Disclosures Tribunal, which is ongoing at Dublin Castle. And Katie Hannan, you've been there every day, and we just want to get really a synopsis of what's happened over the course of the last 5 days. I know a lot has happened, but Noreen O'Sullivan was giving evidence for 3 days. What were the main points of what she had to say?
Well, I mean, I think what Noreen O'Sullivan has sort of done this week in her evidence, and her legal team and the solicitor to that legal team, is that they have kind of put forward an alternative narrative, really, in relation to the Maurice McCabe story and this story that he'd been smeared, in that he's not the only victim in this, and that there were senior guards against whom he had made serious allegations that were very badly affected by this as well. We heard they were in a bad way. There was concerns about their children and their grandchildren. That is what the kind of the coverage of it has taken us to. But I mean, what struck me about Noreen O'Sullivan's evidence was I kept thinking about P. Flynn and Tom Gilmartin, and that line from The Late Late Show where P. Flynn said, you know, he's not well, his wife's not well, he's out of sorts. And that's what we were hearing this week about the view within senior guard, the management, in relation to Maurice McCabe. Noreen O'Sullivan went out of her way to say he was a fantastic guard. She admired him. She thought he had done a great job in bringing forward the allegations of poor policing that he did, that he improved the on guard the Síochána in doing so. But they said that, you know, and she never thought ever in any of this that he had a bad motive in making the allegations that he made. But she said that there was a question mark over why those allegations in his head became also allegations of corruption and malpractice under the Garda Code against senior Gardaí. And the view was that what triggered this was his interactions with the senior Gardaí in the wake of this allegation that was completely dismissed of a child sexual abuse allegation that went to the DPP. DPP completely exonerated him, said it wasn't even, didn't even constitute a crime if it had indeed ever occurred. But that in his interactions with Gardaí in relation to those DPP directions, that this somehow soured his relationship
so
with those officers.
Everything was overplayed.
And everything came from that. That from that point on, he was basically somebody who viewed his senior officers in a different light. So that he was not a bad person, but that perhaps he might be a sad person.
And where did the word paranoid come from?
That was a document that was circulated amongst the legal teams just after Noreen O'Sullivan actually left the stand and her senior counsel took his place in the stand. And Michael McDougall drew the attention of the tribunal to this, to the timing of it to begin with. But also, this was an extract from the Byrne McGinn investigation. This was an investigation by two senior officers into the original allegations of poor policing that Maurice McCabe made in the Cavan Monaghan district way back in 2008. He had never actually seen this full report. And on Thursday, he was presented with a few pages from it, from the introduction of it. And those pages indicated that his senior officer at that time were describing him as a paranoid, as a man who was paranoid, and somebody who had lost control of his station. And Michael McDougall was anxious and said that we should recall Noreen O'Sullivan because he needed to know, did this document and these views feed into the instructions that Noreen O'Sullivan gave to her legal team? And I think the big thing this week is that all the reports that we reported way back when this became a massive controversy back in May 2016, what was said at that O'Higgins commission, what was put to Maurice McCabe, what he was accused of in cross-examination, that he was basically trying to blackmail a senior officer and that's why he made his allegations. All of that has been absolutely confirmed in what we have heard.
Okay.
It is, but the new information that has been come out of this week is that Noreen O'Sullivan said when she said, I want you to challenge his motivation, she did not mean motivation the way the rest of us might. She didn't ever say he had a bad motive. She just said she wanted to understand where he was coming from.
Okay, and there'll be more, no doubt, next week. Well, that's all we have time for. It's my last Saturday show. I'm moving to the news at one, working alternate days with Áine Lawler, and I've worked with great people here, producers and researchers and broadcast coordinators, but a special word of thanks to me from Peter Woods and to Leslie Anderson, who started it all off. Kay Sheehy, who gets gets the Long Service Medal, and my producer today, Anne Farrell, who sees me off with aplomb. I've always appreciated that our guests have given up part of their weekend, part of their Saturday, to be with us. Dara, you've done plenty of them.
I'm sorry.
Thank you all very much indeed for coming in over the last 5.5 years or so. And finally, thank you for listening, and we'll meet again at lunchtime on RT Radio 1, and of course Monday nights on Clare Byrne Live. Bye for now.